I'm David Flaherty, Marketing Director for Washington Wine, and this is Sommelite. Sommelite is a conversation series where we talk to some of our favorite wine pros from around the country, talk a little bit of shop, but more importantly, find out what makes them human and what makes them tick. I'm super excited to welcome to the show today, Brooks Frazier. Brooks has 25 years of experience in the hospitality industry, 17 of those spent in New York City, including time as a bartender, cellar assistant, and sommelier at Gramercy Tavern, one of the renowned and much beloved Juliet Pope. She's also served as head sommelier and wine director at Tom Colicchio's Temple Court at the Beekman Hotel, and as beverage director at Colicchio's flagship restaurant, Kraft New York, which holds a 3-star restaurant rating from the New York Times. An Adirondack native, Brooks has returned to Northern New York to shake, pour, and serve in Saranac Lake and Lake Placid. She's excited to contribute her talent and her knowledge as she sees the great potential to take hospitality to the next level locally. Brooks, it's awesome to see you. Welcome to Sommelite. First off, how are you and where are you?
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited. I am well, and I am in Lake Placid at my little half underground lair.
Your half underground lair. Why is it half underground?
It's a like ground level apartment, but it doesn't, it's not actually a first floor. So yeah, yes. I like to joke that it's half underground.
I lived in a half underground lair my final year in college. Know them well. Getting started. You left New York City about a year and a half ago to move to Lake Placid. So in a little bit of time to reflect, what's one thing that you miss about New York City? And what's one thing that you were super happy to see in the rearview mirror of New York City?
I miss my friends. I miss the energy. Those are probably the two things I would say I miss the most. Rearview mirror, I don't miss the smells. There's a lot of fresh mountain air up here. So it's nice to be surrounded by green and less concrete and metal.
Yeah. New York City is definitely the city of smells.
There's so many smells.
It's so many smells. And I always felt like right when you like start to enjoy the smells, that's when you get hit with like a horrible smell and you're like, your olfactory sense doesn't know whether to continue to smell or not smell in New York City. I hear you. Let's go back a little bit and talk about your career and how you got started, because I remember distinctly realizing when I was a server in a restaurant, how much better the bartenders had it. They made more money. They got more respect from the staff and the guests, and they got a whole court at the bar and play host. How did you get your start in bartending?
So even before I moved to New York, I had a little bartending job in my hometown before I left for college at a really old hotel in a town called Newton Falls. It used to be a paper mill town. Now it's still there, but it barely. But my mom had worked there, so she got me a job. But there I was popping Genesees and mixing squirt and vodka. That was a big drink back then.
No thanks.
So I didn't really, it wasn't really bartending. But when I moved to New York, I got a gig at, one of the first gigs I got was at the Rum House in Times Square. And that was really where I learned everything. I worked with a gentleman named Francisco Jose Lopez, and he was a lifer and so well-loved. He could have traveled and still, I'm sure, could travel anywhere in the world and have friends in every country, every city. And he taught me pretty much all the basics, not just about bartending, but also the way he interacted with people. And, you know, you have to sort of make judgments about people when they walk in the door. So he would give me tips. So yeah, that was sort of where it all really started to become real.
I love that. I mean, you know, it's always interesting to hear like how people ended up in where they are today in the industry. And I feel like there is a very specific route from bartender into wine later on in your life. And I, you know, as a former bartender, but nowhere near the level that you were working at Rum House. I love that bar. It's, for those who don't know, it's a cocktail bar in the middle of Times Square. There's not a lot of cool bars in Times Square, but Rum House is very cool. So I didn't even know you worked there until I was doing research for this call. And I love that spot. So let's talk about that, because there is a totally different skill set to be a bartender than to be a server. You know, you have extended direct contact with the guests. You're not kind of moving in and getting information and moving back out. You're literally like with them and set up for hours sometimes with them. What were some of those early lessons? You mentioned that he gave you some tips. You know, what were some of those early lessons about the industry, about bartending, about yourself that you learned just by being a bartender?
Well, one of the things that he taught me that is super memorable was being in Times Square and being in a hotel. We would get some interesting characters, and we didn't have security or anything at the door. We had an incident one night with someone who came in off the street, and he knew immediately that it was going to be a problem. And I was like, how did you know? And he was like, his shoes. And I was like, so I don't know if that, but he was right. I was like, wow, I'd never even thought of that. So just these little cues that he taught me. But I think since I've done both bartending and serving, like you said, you are a captive audience. So you have to learn how to navigate personalities and be able to talk to anyone about anything. So I remember I worked day shifts at the Rum House, and I would interact with the ticket sellers and the stagehands. So when I would get on the train on the way into work, I would grab all the dailies, Daily News, New York Post. And there was another one, there was three of them, and they were like a quarter or 50 cents at this time. And I would flip through all of them, see the sports sections, look at the over unders for all these like things so that I could talk with all the guys. But I think just recognizing whether people want to be paid attention to or they want to be left alone, that's a huge thing to try to find the answer to immediately when you have somebody sit down at your bar.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very like awkward experience, really. It's like, I'm going to sit at this chair and basically like stare at you for the next couple of hours. And like, you know, maybe we'll be friends, maybe we won't. You know, you get pretty good at reading people. What were some of the things you learned about people in that first stint at Rum House that maybe you carry to this day?
I think that people just want, when they want to be heard and seen, they will let you know. And figuring out a way to be able to do that for them without absorbing their energy. So being able to interact with them and you know, sometimes it's, you're sort of playing the, you know, it's a common theme in bartending. You're sort of playing the psychologist and just being able to decide, you know, like, they want me to hear them. They want advice. They just want me to listen and say, oh, wow. You know, some people don't want advice. They just want you to sort of commiserate and be like, yeah, I get it. Wow. I can't believe she said that. So I think just recognizing what people need was a huge lesson. And still to this day, you know, when people walk in the door at the restaurant, sort of recognizing that sign that they have around their neck, whether it's in fine print and they want you to come close and, you know, listen or not, or it's in all caps screaming, like, I will demand attention the entire time or whatever it is. So, yeah.
Yeah. You know, I think like in our industry where it is such a people focused industry, also it's with bartending and a spot like that. I mean, this is for, again, just to give a little context, Rum House, you know, has hundreds of rare, unique spirits from around the world and incredibly complicated cocktails to make. So just the service aspect that you had to deal with was extensive. Also though, like, there's nowhere to run. There's nowhere to hide. There's nowhere to sit down. So you're literally, as a bartender, on your feet for 6, 7, 8 hours, whatever it is. Maybe you can sit down for a minute or two or take a quick lunch break. But for the most part, you're visible and Everyone can see everything. They can see when you're stressed. They can see when you're panicked, when like tickets are coming. How did you kind of like adapt? And I think this probably would serve you later in your career to like, you know, knowing that you're visible and you are stressed or you're feeling anxiety, but you have to kind of like continue to manage that. So you continue to create that air of calm. Was that something for you as a person that came naturally for you?
Not necessarily. And to be quite honest, it's something that I wasn't necessarily super good at when I started at the Rum House, and I was there, and you know, this was a part-time gig that I I worked there as I finished school. So I will say that that was something, not only did Jose, because he went by Jose, you know, teach me how to make cocktails and drinks. That's also something that he, because he was always so even keeled, like could not be shook for anything. And, you know, I was super young at the time. I had just moved to the city. So it was definitely something that I was cultivating and not necessarily came natural. I could always sort of talk to anyone up until that point, but I had never lived in a city like New York. I came from a super rural area. I had been to college for a couple of years, but again, it was a small little town that I went to school in. So it was a whole new world. And not only in New York, but you're in Times Square. So it's like the tourist mecca. So you're getting, you know, the best and the worst of people. So it was definitely something that I cultivated over the years there and really did learn. I have to give Jose a lot of credit because he was an amazing teacher, not only in like the spirits and cocktail arena, but as a people watcher and people whisper.
The human whisper?
Yeah, the people whisper.
Oh my gosh. I mean, yeah. I mean, some of the best bartenders I worked with, you know, I was always amazed at how one person could kind of keep track of a dozen people, two dozen people at once. Where are they? You know, what's the energy in the room? And you're just one person back there. So it's important that you're like putting out this air of confidence, like I'm in charge here. I mean, it's a pretty like bizarre dynamic. And I learned a lot from it and about life as well. Why and when did you leave the bar side of the industry and then go to the restaurant side of the industry? And what was that transition like for you? But at this point, did you know that like this was where you might want to spend some of your career, or was it still just kind of these side jobs that ended up becoming your main jobs?
Yeah. So it was, the plan was always to go back to school, and I did. And I went back to school while I worked in restaurants and bars, but it was never, I was never like, I'm going to be in hospitality, not because I didn't like it or anything. It just, I, you know, was like, I'm going to go to school and I'm going to get a degree and I'm going to go into a career that has to do with that degree. But I switched from Rum House to, well, I just went down the block to Bluefin, and that was sort of, I was still bartending in the Fishbowl there in the front was where I spent most of my time. But that was more of a restaurant scene, and we did a ton of pre-theater, which you know. So from there, that was sort of, Bluefin was where I really got more into wine actually and curious about it. We had a beverage director there who was a really great teacher, and I really became interested in the process of winemaking and farming and all of that. That was sort of where it first started. But then as the years went on and I finished my undergrad, and then I decided I thought I was going to go to law school. And then in the middle of the LSAT, there was a question on the LSAT, and I was like, what am I doing? I don't want to be a lawyer. So I ended up going to Baruch and I got my master's degree.
Can we pause there real quick? What was the question? What was the question on your LSAT? Do you remember?
I don't remember exactly, but it was the intro to the actual question was, you know, writing for law is devoid of creativity.
Oh, wow.
And I was like, but I'm like a creative person, you know, and all of this. Yeah. And I'm sitting in the front of this room. I took it at Queens College where I got my undergrad. So, but I was sitting in the front and the door was open and the elevator also kept opening and closing. So there was this like dinging, and I was reading this question. And I was just like, what am I doing?
You're like, this doesn't feel right.
Yeah. But at that point in my mind, I was the following semester, I was meant to be going to school. So I was like, I had to think of a different plan. So that's how I ended up at Baruch. I got my master's in public administration there. My focus was policy research, more specifically like environmental policy. I did a lot of research on food deserts and food justice. And I was going to go into nonprofit or government. But this was when I finished, right at the sort of tail end of the recession. So government and nonprofit positions were sort of harder to come by and monetarily not, you know, very, it just wasn't sustainable to be living in New York and have a position as, you know, an entry-level nonprofit. Like, it just wasn't a thing. So I had restaurants to sort of count on and fall back into. And that's what I did. I stayed and I ended up back at Be Our Guest because I had left while I finished school. And I was at Bill's in Rock Center when they first opened, and then Bill's in Meatpacking for a while, which was really fun. That was a trip. But then I ended up landing at Gramercy Tavern. And that was when it sort of shifted in my mind, meeting all these people that were amazing professionals and just that, you know, environment. And then I was like, okay, this can be a career. I can see how this can work for me. So
I want to get into Gramercy Tavern because that's an amazing place. Before we jump to there though, with Be Our Guest, and we keep saying these terms like people know. So Be Our Guest Hospitality is a restaurant group. A number of restaurants. Owned by Landry's now, if you want to get in the restaurant weeds. But yeah, so we both, you and I both worked at a restaurant called Bluefin, which is right in the heart of Times Square. One thing I thought was interesting though is you became a trainer, meaning you were training people, and this was a very rule heavy restaurant to work in. A lot of punishments, a lot of rules. Truth be told, it kind of burned me out on restaurants. I was like, I gotta get out of here. I was not very happy there. But as a trainer, I'm curious, you're training all these people, seeing them kind of come in, and I'm sure over time you got good at being like, they're gonna make it, they're not gonna make it. What were some of those approaches that you found most effective to get people on board? Like when you were training them, like, did you, you know, like outside of hospitality in the restaurants, like now you're kind of like waking people up to like, hey, here's how to succeed here. Like, what were some of those approaches? What did people show you? What did they need to be successful in that company? And what were you primarily starting to teach them over time?
Well, I think in general, to be successful in high pressure restaurant environments, because there's lots of different vibes in restaurants, right? And then, but I would say in big, busy restaurants where you're really turning a lot of tables and there's a huge staff, I think understanding that for these couple of hours, you are putting on a show and you have to mentally prepare for that. And you have to sort of leave things at the door when you walk through. And I think how well people are at that and having that click in their mind, because it didn't click for me for a while. You know, I started to get a little burnout and I was like, why am I doing this? It's very emotionally taxing to have people talk at you all day and have all these super high expectations that are, you know, sometimes reasonable, but sometimes completely unreasonable and sometimes completely unhinged. But being able to navigate that and also getting good at not taking anything personally, like nothing is about you. When someone is rude or, you know, you have a negative interaction, it's rarely about you. It's really about the person that is coming at you like that. So I think people that understand that have a higher success rate and of, you know, actually being able to enjoy the job, because it can be very enjoyable. You meet tons of cool people, you work with cool people. And if you are in a good company or good place, you also have the opportunity to learn a ton of things about food and beverage, not just about like what's on the plate, but where it comes from, the processes and the people that are involved in that. And that to me is super interesting. So having a little bit of passion for that helps too.
You said something that was interesting to me. You said this earlier too at Rum House when you're bartending. You mentioned being able to feel and sense people's energy, but not to be kind of like sucked into it. Yeah. That's hard.
So hard.
And I think, you know, you just said it again with teaching them that like it's not personal, you know, that emotion or energy you feel. Like, I don't think people realize that very much who don't work in restaurants is like how much energy is thrown at you from people and how different it can be. No one's good at things 100% of the time, but are you good at that? Are you good at like allowing people's energy to be felt, but you can keep a nice healthy distance from it? Or is that something that you're constantly in tension with?
I think I would like to think I'm practiced enough now, but I use that word practice because it is a practice. It took me years to get to that point. And it took me working with a lot of people that were already good at it to learn from them. So when I have that opportunity, you probably know, like, once you reach a certain age in this industry, you end up working with a lot of younger people. Mm-hmm. And there's the challenges that come with that, but there's the benefits because they have this young, fun energy. But being able to sort of guide them and let them know, like, that interaction was not about you. It's nothing you did wrong. There are things potentially in the future that you could do differently that might make it turn out a different way. But it's a practice. I would like to think I'm a lot better at it now. But of course, there are days where, you know, you're like, ugh, this guy, like, no.
Yeah. You need to, like, do a 5-mile run and then take a 20-minute hot shower to, like, reset yourself after. But yeah. Like, what are some of those things you tell yourself? Like, when you're in those situations and you set it to practice, you know, a lot of times there's reminders with your practice. Are there reminders you give yourself to, like, help you stay centered amongst crazy people?
I think in the moment I can almost immediately identify people now and just by the way they ask questions or, you know, how they view the table that they're presented. You can tell, like, they're unhappy and they're, like, mm-hmm. looking around, like, is there a better table? Like, why am I sitting here? So you are starting to read people from the moment they walk in the door, and you're already preparing yourself for what could come. And of course, I like to think the best of people, but you also have to be prepared what you're going to say and how you're going to navigate if it gets a little challenging or difficult. But I think it's the sort of the work outside of the restaurant. Like, I started practicing yoga very early on. So I've been now almost doing yoga for 20 years. And then I've gotten into meditation over the past 10-ish years, I would say. And being able to sort of fall into that sort of Zen area and just ride that out. So I think you do have to be able to do a little bit of work outside, but that is not only helpful in challenging situations in a restaurant, but challenging situations in life. So it's super useful. But yeah, I think that's probably is one of the things that's been really helpful to me. And, you know, realizing the only thing that you can control in any given situation is how you react to it. So as a person who likes to think I have control over things, accepting that there is only a little bit that you actually do control. And that makes it easier to sort of settle into things. So,
yeah. So if you could boil down all those years of training and mentoring at Be Our Guest, which, like you said, is a high volume, high stress environment. I mean, in terms of restaurants, like, it doesn't get more intense than that. At least that was for me. I had never operated on that level. And it's a very intense environment. You were there for 6 years, you know, you saw many people come in and many people leave. But in that time, if looking back, what are, like, three of the biggest lessons that anyone needs to know about the restaurant and bar industry if they want to make a career in it?
I would say, number one, which I have already said, not to take anything personally. That's a huge one. It's usually never about you. It's always about the person's day or life or, you know, something that they're dealing with and how they're going to come at you. So not taking things personally, being able to having a sense of humor and being able to laugh is a huge one, which sort of, I guess, would go hand in hand with that, not taking anything personally. Just being able to be like, wow, that person was out of control or ridiculous or whatever it is. And I guess, does that count as two? And I think having some sort of, I want to say passion, but at least an interest in the things that you're presenting to people. It's a lot easier to be able to talk to people and get them excited about something if you're excited about it as well. So whether that's, you know, spirits and cocktails, or you're more into wine, or even the food menu, but having because if you're not into it, it's really hard, because while you are putting on a show and you can sort of fake some of it there, I do think there has to be some nugget in there buried that you are interested in your own life. Like, you love to eat and drink, so that carries over.
Yeah. Or hospitality and taking care of people has to yes. be blood, right? Yeah. So you spent nearly 4 years at Gramercy Tavern. And again, for those who don't know or work in restaurants, this is like playing for the New York Yankees. And arguably, you know, it's one of the most beloved, revered, highly reviewed restaurants in the world. And the way they do things is very unique. How had your background up until then prepared you to work there? And then what were some of the differences right away about Gramercy Tavern than anywhere else that you'd worked before? Help people understand why is this place so special, and how, were you ready for it, and how was it different? What did you learn?
Well, I thought I was ready for it, for sure. After working in a high volume place like Bluefin, where you do a lot of pre-theater, and it's very, for, you know, those 2-3 hours, you're full speed ahead, busy, and also busy brunches, not just pre-theater. But I think once you work high volume bartending, whether it's in a restaurant like that or clubs, there is this sense of like, you can do anything, and you can to a certain degree, but I don't know if I was fully prepared for Gramercy Tavern. And I think there was a period while, especially in the first couple of months, because my experience there was sort of unique in that usually the bartenders had started as back waiters or servers. So, and they worked their way up through the ranks, where they were hiring, looking for a bartender specifically at that point. So I don't know if I was like the first person that was hired into a bartender position. But I do remember that it was a unique situation, because everyone told me it was. And there's definitely in the first couple of months, this sort of that imposter syndrome that came in, that I was affected by. Kevin Mahan was the GM at the time, who I love. But he was a very tough boss, I guess. Like, there was we made a video for him once, and I still think of like the interview, like the soundbite I did. And it was like, you could do something right 99 times. The one time you did it wrong, he would see you and you'd be like, but I did it right all the other times. So, but service bar at Gramercy Tavern, super high pressure, because you have all these captains that have been there for years, like looking at you like, why can't you do this faster? And where's this? And yeah, it was a humbling couple of months. And there were definitely nights where I was like, I'm going to get fired. But the team there is so amazing. And there is this balance between, you know, pushing and, but also being very supportive. So I just feel so fortunate for my time there. But the first couple of months were definitely a time where I was like, I thought I was a good bartender.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, years of experience, you're training people, and then you go to this place and all of a sudden it's like, who are you? Right. You got to prove yourself all over again.
Exactly. Yeah.
You'd mentioned that that's where you really kind of started to fall in love with wine, was at Gramercy Tavern. And again, in terms of a beverage list and a wine list, it's incredible. The amount of, you know, the features and spotlights and how much it changes. What was it about their approach to wine, the philosophy of wine that they had, that really kind of sparked something interesting for you?
Well, I think, well, Juliet was the beverage director at the time when I was there. But Kevin was also very much involved because he was a huge beer fan. And so we had the vintage beers as well. But I think between the two of them, the passion for beverage, from not only spirits and wine, but the coffee program, like everything was, you know, top notch, top tier. We're not settling for less. But we tasted wine every day. We talked about wine every day. And Juliet was amazing in finding these super cool wines that were made by super cool people that came from super cool places. So I felt like every day I was learning so many new things that were fascinating. Like I remember one of the, when I first learned about the Canary Islands, my mind was blown. Like it was just amazing. And she was also a huge champion of domestic wines and specifically New York wines. So sort of opening my eyes to what was sort of right in the backyard was also really great. But yeah, I mean, the bar team, and at the time we didn't have a dedicated wine team. That came a couple of years into my time there, but everyone was expected. If you were a captain or a front waiter, everyone was expected to know the wine list, to be able to navigate it and to talk about it to, you know, a certain degree. So the expectations were really high, and I love a good challenge. If I could go to school forever and learn forever, I would. So that environment was the perfect place for me because every pre-shift we were tasting wine and talking about wine. So that really planted the seed and it started to really open my eyes to this amazing world.
Mentorship is a huge part of our industry. Whether you're on the production side for wine or beer, you know, who you end up working with is who you really learn a lot from. A lot of it's more than just kind of like how they, you know, go about their job, in your case, like at night or during the shifts, but also like kind of how they hold themselves as professionals. And you arguably got a mentor with one of the best in the biz. And this is Juliette Pope that you mentioned. For those that don't know her, can you talk a little bit about who she is? What were some of the skills and lessons you learned from her? And then I gather that you kind of, she kind of took you under her wing and started to work with you and develop you. Talk a little bit about her and that process and what are some of the things you learned from her?
Yeah, she's amazing. I thought about wearing I have multiple Juliette Pope shirts that Stephen Solomon, who was a captain at Gramercy Tavern and just a character in the hospitality world in New York City, if you don't know him, you should look him up, and an amazing artist also. But he made a bunch of Juliette Pope shirts. I definitely like hold her in the highest regard as a person, as a mentor. I was amazed by her because she started in the kitchen and she worked for years in the kitchen before she ever came to the front of house, and immediately coming to the front of house sort of worked her way up and was the beverage director, I think fairly quickly. I don't know the exact timeline, but just that trajectory was not super common to make that shift from the back house to front of house and be that good at it and successful that quickly. So I always admired her, like just the skill set, the range of things that she could do. I was always amazed by, but she's another person who I really learned that the way to like that energy and the way to carry yourself. She was always very even keeled. She could command a room without trying. She could see everything, and she coached in a way that made you not feel bad, which I think is an amazing skill that I've always hoped that I could emulate from her, being able to correct people and say, you know, do it this way, but not feel bad about it. So she was always really good at that. And just, again, like, the organization of the cellar, her passion for things and having everything, you know, ready to go for staff as far as information. Like when there was a new wine on, we had all the information we needed about the wine to hit the ground running for guests that night. So there was never like, oh yeah, we do have that new wine, but I don't really know much about it yet, or I haven't tried it yet. Like that would never be the case at Gramercy. We were always super well prepared. And for us to be well prepared, she had to be beyond prepared. So I was always totally in awe of her and her capability. She's like a super human woman. I don't even know.
She's incredible. Absolutely incredible. Is. Just one of the most unique people in the business. And wow, the amount of people she's mentored and inspired is hundreds, thousands. Now, it's a huge leap to go from where you were to management, which eventually you did. What was that transition like for you? You know, I think anyone in any industry, be it hospitality or, you know, wine production, whatever it is, when you're going to management, it's a different ballgame. Were you prepared? And what did you need to learn right out of the gate that was new or unexpected?
I don't think I was necessarily prepared. And management was something that I, for many years, never really thought seriously about because I didn't expect to stay in restaurants because I was going to school and I was going to end up, you know, with a career related to my degree. So it was never anything that I really thought about. But when I did finally move into management, this would have been at Temple Court. It was the first time I moved from head somm to the wine director. I don't think I was prepared, and it wasn't because of anything, you know, lacking in the company. It was just, it's a huge leap. Like you said, like it's, you don't have the flexibility of being an hourly anymore. So even so, small things like that, scheduling, like you have to be there because you're the one that's there. And walking into things with, you know, this plan in mind of today, we're going to taste the new wine and I'm going to do this in the cellar. But then you walk in and it's like a pipe burst and you're the manager on duty. So you have to figure out what needs to happen. It was super challenging for me. And also navigating personalities in the staff in a way that you didn't have to do as an hourly. And that was hard. That was hard for me. Like the disciplinary stuff, the like sort of HRE sort of stuff. I never felt confident and comfortable doing. I would say that even today, if I was to go back into management, that would probably be the most challenging and my least favorite part, which maybe that's the case for most people, but it really, that was really sort of the most challenging for me and was always the thing that made me question whether I was good enough to be a manager.
Yeah. I mean, you're thrown in the deep end. And like you said, it's everything. It's beyond everything you've done on the floor up until then. Cause it's,
yeah.
Now it's all the behind the scenes stuff. It's, you know, profit and loss statements, and you're responsible now for financial health of the restaurant, as well as all the operational challenges. You know, I think a lot of people in our industry that maybe are servers or they're sommeliers right now, but they're not sort of in the beverage director, wine director position, but they want to be. What do you think the most important skills are that they can work on or that they need to know before they make that jump? Or is it just always going to just be that massive void and you just got to jump in? I mean, is there anything they can do to prepare themselves, or what are the skills they should be developing now before they become a management that could help them?
I talked earlier about not taking things personally when you're interacting with guests. I think not taking things personally when you're interacting with your staff, because that, while I can sort of have the, create the space between me and guests, because it's a, you know, there's a start time and an end time. And yes, I may see you again in the future, but it's a shorter time. But when you, you know, develop relationships with your staff and you have people of all ages from all different backgrounds with all different stories and own their own challenges, it gets harder to not take things personally, because you feel like there's moments where you feel like you have failed someone and that you couldn't give them enough or do enough to set them up for success. So I think, again, trying to you know, have in your mind, finding this balance of being able to be empathetic and understanding and trying to coach people and mentor people, but also realizing there's only so much you can do and there, it's a give and take. So you have to sort of pick your battles and realize when someone's just there to clock in, clock out, make money and go, even if you see something in them they don't see in themselves, you sort of have to let things go. And again, like coming from a place where I like to have some level of predictability and control, you have to let that go as well in management. Because like I said, you have a whole plan for a day, but when something goes wrong, it's out the window and you don't know when you're going to get back to that. So I think being flexible and just ready to roll and ride the wave, roll the punches, ride the wave, whatever you want to say. It is more challenging because you create more personal relationships with these people because you're with them a lot. So it's hard when there's, you know, tension or negativity, not just between potentially you and staff members, but within the staff and navigating that. It's super challenging. I don't know. Like, and also, you know, like you said, the financial side of things and taking on that level of responsibility, it's all a lot. And knowing that if you're doing your best and the people, your team around you of managers are all doing their best, then that's all you can do. And hopefully that's enough. And hopefully there's someone there that can tell you whether it is enough or not, or guide you when it's not. So hopefully people are lucky enough to have a support system in place in their companies, if they're those big teams, because I worked with some big teams. Yeah.
The challenges on the management side are immense. There's many, and hence I'm always a big believer, anybody that's been a restaurant manager has created any job. Because of what they learned. What were on the like, you know, positive like side, what were some of the best things about being a wine director?
Oh man, there's so many. Some of my favorite things about being a wine director was sharing the passion for your favorite things. And when you see your staff, like something light up in them or something clicks, you know, that is super rewarding, being able to share that passion. And when it sort of starts to like rub off on people, that's really nice. And the people that you meet, tasting with the people that are making the wine and literally touching the dirt and in the vineyards, that was a huge thing. I love, you know, cocktails and spirits and still do, but once I started really focusing on wine and the fact that it's farming at its base, like that for me, because I would love to have like a little farm and some chickens and, you know, have that. So I think that part of the job, meeting the people and just trying to absorb everything that they have learned and what their story that they're telling through their wines. Those are some of the favorite things. And the travel and being able to see the places where the products are coming from, all of those things were definitely my favorite parts. And I do miss that at this point. Yeah.
Yeah. So like many, you left NYC in 2020 due to the pandemic and its effect on the hospitality industry, and probably for, you know, many other reasons, all kind of rolled up into one that kind of was like, all right, it's time to go. What were those final days like for you before you left? And then when you got up to where you landed now in Northern New York, what were those first few days like for you? So, you know, what was the last few days like in New York City? And then what was like kind of the start of that next chapter like for you as you started up there?
Well, when I initially left the city, it wasn't a final decision. It was like, I'm getting out of the city because we've been under lockdown now it started in mid-March and I left at the end of May, beginning of June. So we'd been under lockdown for like 2.5-3 months at that point. And my parents had tried to convince me multiple times, you know, and I was like, well, I'm trying to wait to see what's going to happen. Like, cause we knew nothing at that point. And, you know, we stayed in touch. I was at Kraft at that time. I was the beverage director at Kraft. So we stayed in touch and talked on the phone and had Zooms, but there were no answers. So, but I was like, I'm going to wait it out. Like, what if we reopen and I'm not here? So the last couple of days in New York were sort of a blur. Like I rented a car. It was actually a Jeep Grand Cherokee or something. And I had taken in a cat and had a bunch of houseplants and didn't really know what it was going to look like, but just walked. I remember I had to walk to the Upper West Side from my place on 145th in Amsterdam. And, you know, at that point we still were masked and gloved and we still didn't really know exactly what was happening. And, you know, I get in the car and I'm like spraying like all the sanitizer and all of that. It was a little scary, to be honest, but I literally just packed up the car and drove upstate. And I had a family friend who wasn't at their place near my parents. So my parents, I grew up in a little town called Star Lake, which is about an hour and a half from where I am now in Lake Placid, still in the Adirondack Park, but there's a little cabin. And I was so afraid that I was going to be the North Country COVID spreader, even though I'd had no contact with anyone besides, you know, at that point I went to the rental car place. But we took it so seriously in New York. Like, we did not leave our apartments. If we did, it was, you know, a solo walk. Like, I remember the first time I met up with a friend, it was Isabella. She walked from Brooklyn. I walked from the Upper West Side. We met in Central Park. And even at that time we were outside, we still sat like 10 feet apart from each other, didn't, you know, hug or like say hi. And this was the first time we'd seen each other in person. So I would say it was scary. And it wasn't a definitive, like, I'm leaving New York now after 17 years. It was like, I'm going to be back. I kept my apartment. And then 2 months later, so now we're in full swing of summer and things were still not reopening, I knew I had to make a decision at that point because it didn't make sense to keep my apartment in the city, but be up here. And I decided that I was going to let the apartment in the city go and figure out what the next adventure was. And I really thought I would end up in the Hudson Valley, downstate, closer to the city still. Friends were there. A lot of people ended up up there in the Catskills. And I actually stored my stuff when I first moved out of my apartment in the Hudson Valley. But then after spending time here in the Adirondacks, closer to my family, I decided that I was going to give it a try here. So I got the job at the Hotel Saranac, which was crazy and chaotic, but fun. And I loved being back in the mountains. I mean, I got to go hiking, running, biking every day in a way that I hadn't been able to do to that extent in many, many years. So yeah, it was scary. It was eye-opening. There was lots of second guessing, like, am I doing the right thing? But at the end of the day, I was like, I can always go back to New York. Like, if I really want to, it's going to be there. So yeah, I went all in for Adirondacks.
We all talk about like the work-life balance, and it's nearly impossible, I think, you know, especially in hearing some of your stories about, you know, New York City restaurant management, it's nearly impossible. And maybe that's not what it's for. Maybe it's meant to be kind of a training ground that then you take on to your next chapter. You do seem to have found a little bit more of that work-life balance from what you said. Are you able to kind of bring that energy that you loved about New York City restaurants to the operations now in the Adirondacks with your skills and still kind of exercise all those muscles that you love to exercise, but then you can like leave it behind and go to your life? And now you have a life. Is that what it's like for you?
Yeah, I think just exactly how you said it, that is facts. Where I am now, I got super lucky. I am at a little restaurant in Lake Placid. It's right across the street from my house. I get to walk to work. I'm working 4 or 5 days a week. We only serve dinner. We have, you know, we do usually between 30 and 40 covers a night. And it's still a high level of service. And, you know, Chef Andrea has a high level of expectation for how things will play out, as well as my coworker Liz, who's the front of house manager. And we're, I would say, the best restaurant in Lake Placid.
What's the name of it?
Salt of the Earth Bistro.
Salt of the Earth. Okay.
Yep. Salt of the Earth Bistro. they just had their 5-year anniversary, and what they've built, I think, is amazing. You know, and I say, I think we're the best restaurant, but we are like very highly reviewed and people are always very complimentary. And we do get a lot of people from the city, and I can tell when people are from the city. So it, depending on the rapport, it comes up and they're like, oh yeah, I was like, yeah, I used to work in the city. So, but I do think, to try to get back to what you actually asked me, work-life balance. Yes. And I think it's something that I don't know would have happened had the pandemic not happened, because I think not only like leaving the city and these, you know, sort of bigger, higher pressure positions, but also having that downtime for those couple of months where that's the longest I hadn't worked in my adult life. Like I started working, I couldn't even drive a car yet. I was 14 or 15. I had to go get a special card from the school that said I could work. So I've been working, not obviously full-time when I was a child, but like working basically full-time my entire life. So those couple of months between when COVID hit and then working at Hotel Saranac in September. So, you know, that whole summer I didn't work. That was the longest I'd never worked. So deprogramming this idea that the hours at work or productivity is tied to your worth, I think is a huge thing that I've been, and a lot of us have been sort of working through and dealing with, and realizing how much happier you can be with downtime and in downtime. And yeah, I've noticed a huge shift in my mentality and my priorities. So it's been really, it's nice, and it is refreshing and humbling, all of those things.
Yeah. What a journey.
Yeah.
but to also get to continue to, you know, exercise those skills and
that
we love about hospitality, but to have a life and to have some balance. We're going to switch gears.
Okay.
And do some rapid fire questions. Do you have a middle name? If so, what is it? And what do you think of middle names in general?
My middle name is Lynn. So I am Brooks Lynn Frazier. I love a middle name. I love especially if it's quirky, like a quirky family name. I'm all for them.
pro middle name.
Yes.
There are two types of people in this world. Those who hit snooze on their alarm and those who do not. Which camp are you in?
Oh, big snoozer.
Big snoozer?
Huge snoozer, multiple snoozer, big napper, big sleeper.
Now that you're in the mountains, are you on like nature time, or are you still staying up until 2 a.m. and sleeping until 10:30?
No, I am it even started during lockdown. My apartment had great windows on my 145th and Amsterdam apartment, and I left the curtains open and I would be up with the sun and sort of go to bed, you know, 10 o'clock. And
wow,
it's carried over. I'm up early and I'm usually to bed by midnight. If I'm up past midnight, it's like, I'm like, what's going on? It's a special occasion.
The mountains like unlocked your like actual normal rhythm.
Yeah. Which is a total change.
Yeah.
Which, you know, we're like, especially being the closing manager, you walk out the door at, you know, 1-2 o'clock and you're like, gotta go have a drink.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Home at 4 a.m. in bed and then sleep for a couple hours and do it all over again. But yeah, there is something to be said for that as well. I didn't like not like it, but I do feel like this is a more natural way to be. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Do you cook spaghetti whole or do you break it in half?
Oh, never break it in half. I used to before I knew better. But yeah, I would never now.
For somebody that breaks it in half, why would you tell them not to break it in half?
Because you don't have to. I don't know. Just wait. Just
you don't put have it, you to? Know,
yeah. You put it in the pan and it goes in by itself.
Yeah. Show some respect for the noodle. What's the last photo that you took on your phone? And can you show us?
Oh boy. I don't know. There's a lot of screenshots lately because I'm going on a little trip and I've been screenshotting restaurant ideas. It is a screenshot. It's my flight information, but actual picture that I took besides the setup for this, because I wanted to see what the lighting looked like, would be of my cat
on the
bed.
Oh, yeah. Oh, look at that.
There's lots of cat pictures.
There's lots of cat pictures.
That's Bella.
TikTok or Instagram?
Both. I mean, I
feel like I've been seeing more and more TikTok from you recently. Maybe.
Yeah. Maybe TikTok.
I'm not on TikTok. I feel like you share TikTok stuff on other platforms, though.
Yes.
Making me want to try TikTok more.
What's that?
Making me want to try TikTok more. I do like random dance videos. I've been told, like, well, then go to TikTok. I'm like, eh, I'll get there.
Yeah. It's so I am more, I would say, involved on Instagram. Like, I will post on Instagram. Right now, TikTok is more of like, I am not a poster. I'm just a watcher, but exactly.
Yeah.
During the pandemic, like especially during lockdown, that it was a really great way to find a laugh and see that you were not alone. And I think that's still very much the case. And I tell my coworkers, because both my coworkers now, I'm like, don't do it, don't do it. But it is fascinating because your For You page is really for you. So like, you know, you have an experience that is truly unique to you. So it's not, I sometimes think that I need to take a social media break, but I think it's more just about moderation. So
yeah, that's the great challenge for sure. What is something that people are always surprised to learn about you?
Oh, I don't know. My age?
Hmm.
Recently, I guess, because I sort of had a milestone birthday. So maybe my age, but also I think that I grew up in Star Lake, spent so much time in the city, and now I'm back. Like, people are always like, oh, wow, that's such a interesting path. Like, how did you end up in New York coming from such a rural place? And how did you come back? I guess, I don't know.
That's awesome. Those are the extremes, right? You're the salmon that returns back to the ancestral spawning grounds of Star Lake. Did you bring a pen and piece of paper with you?
I did.
Okay.
I follow instructions.
Thank you for following instructions. We are going to do the Somlight drawing challenge. Let's see. You're going to draw a picture of something, which I'll think of in a second, while teaching us about the wine. We're going to go New York wines for the New York homage. We'll do North Fork of Long Island.
Okay.
You're going to have 45 seconds to teach us about the North Fork of Long Island while drawing a picture of you and your Jeep Cherokee with your cat leaving New York City.
Oh my God, this is so hard, David. Oh my gosh.
Kind of felt cruel, like the more I described what you need to do.
I'm like,
you got this, Brooks. You got this.
What am I going to say about North Fork while I'm trying to draw? Okay.
All right. So I'm going to start the clock. Are you ready?
Okay. Yeah.
Here we go. Begin.
Okay. So the North Fork of Long Island, super unique place to grow wine. Used to be lots of potato farms. So think very flat. And it is, its proximity to water moderates, I'm not drawing, I'm just talking, moderates the temperature. But there still is a huge diurnal shift. So nice, warm, sunny days and then cool nights. So really great for certain varietals. What else can I say about North Fork? I love a lot of the producers there. Some of them are actually personal friends. Shout out Brewster McCall and the team at Pominock. I love them. Macari. But I think they're doing great stuff with Bordeaux varietals. They make some really pretty Pinot Noirs. I think it has all the potential in the world. And I'm trying to really finish
up a song. You're at time.
Okay. It's so bad.
I cannot wait to see this picture.
I did get the cat in there.
All right, let's see it. Oh, wait, waiting for the focus. Oh, wait, little, oh, hold on. Oh, there it is, there it is. Ooh, oh, he looks so happy. He's like watching the Empire State Building fade in the mirror, in the window.
Yeah.
Oh, that's good, Brooks. It's good. I mean, the cat's emotion and expression are just so telling.
Yes.
The drawing's very sophomoric, I'll be honest with you. The cat is alive.
The cat was the most important thing.
The cat was most important. Who cares about the Jeep Cherokee? You nailed the cat. That was...
But that's really hard to try to talk with any sort of command about a place while also trying to draw.
Well, you did great. And you nailed Pominac and Cream. I also am a big fan of that producer and their Shannon Block is awesome. Okay, last question for you. You came out to Washington State a few years ago and spent about a week here and really got a deep dive into Washington. And today you continue to support the Wines of Washington. So thank you for that. What is it about Washington that like struck you as unique and different from, say, New York or California or other domestic producers? Like, what is it that makes Washington unique for you?
My trip to Washington was eye-opening because I had no idea the actual climate that they're growing in. Because I had no idea that they're irrigating. Like, it's, you just have this idea, this vision of like rainy Seattle, and you know, that's what you think of the whole state. And you cross those mountains and you're like, oh, it is not that way at all. I think the people that I met were also, that's one of my favorite parts of this business. And there was no shortage of amazing, nice, genuine people that are super passionate about what they're doing, but also super supportive of the sort of the goal of Washington State and getting the word out about the quality. And I do think the quality of the wines is amazing and on par with anything that you can find anywhere in the old world. So yeah, and it was just such a fun trip. It was, I don't know, what else can I say? Did I answer the question?
You did. Thank you. Well, it was an honor to have you out here, and I look forward to getting you out here again. And, you know, you're so inspiring for people that are looking for their path and trying to blend career with life and how to find that. And I, you know, who knows where you'll end up. It's just so rewarding and refreshing to hear that you found this really cool niche for yourself that was unexpected. And I hope it's inspiring to others. It's inspiring to me, certainly. Thank you so much, Brooks, for being here today. Thank you all for listening. Stay well, stay healthy. This has been Somlight, and we look forward to seeing you next time with some of our other favorite wine personalities from around the country. Thanks so much, Brooks.
Thank you.